Welcome to Mustard Mayonnaise. I'm Matt.
I am Richard.
And we sort of have a conversation about whatever captures our interest in the entertainment industry. Often this includes new movies, reviews, whatever's going on in the TV world. When that fails, we talk about movies from 10, 15 years ago as if they're somehow relevant today.
And when that fails, I yell at my dog.
Okay, well, that's what you have to look forward to for the next 45 to 60 minutes. Okay. So I didn't really see anything new this week. In fact, over the past couple of weeks, I'm kind of slacking.
I haven't either. I've just been, like, just working too damn hard.
So this is going to be one of the less topical episodes. Although, as you were just trolling the headlines, you discovered that Scary Movie 4 did, like, $40 million this
Jesus, do you have any interest ever in seeing any of these movies?
You know, maybe if it was, like, at a party and someone's like, oh, this is a great party film. Because, like, David Cross was in, like, the first one or two, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think number two.
Although, I would think going into that, there'd be, like, three scenes with David Cross, and they really wouldn't be that funny.
Yeah.
You'd end up being disappointed if that's your reason for seeing it. But I am seeing a lot of TV advertising for it. They keep showing the Dr. Phil bit and Shaq, and yet I have no interest. You're entirely correct.
Well, you know
who is seeing this film?
You know what's weird about them is that they originally started as Marlon and Damon and
right.
Keenan Ivory Wayans or some form of the Wayans brothers. And at the time it was considered weird. They're making this totally non-urban thing, which is like, I mean, what kind of a weird racist statement is that you're like surprised they're doing it, but they did them. And if I remember right, they did one and two. And then when they did three wasn't as successful as they hoped. And then this one, I don't know if they promoted or they created the idea or whatever, but they're off the project totally because now they brought one of the guys who directed Airplane, one of the Zucker brothers, so to direct this one. So it's just kind of interesting. But whatever executive made that decision, it clearly paid off because they're making a mint on this thing.
Boy, it's interesting because I have no interest in seeing that.
It's weird how they market it too. I mean, they what they do is they fill it up with celebrities from different worlds.
Yeah, you've got Leslie Nielsen, Shaq, Dr. Phil.
Exactly. So if you're watching afternoon television, you're seeing all these Dr. Phil jokes. If you're watching ESPN, you're seeing all of these sports characters.
Yeah,
you know, it's just kind of funny how they really market that.
Let's throw a bunch of crap in a blender and... God, did you see the South Park? Well, I guess if you've been busy, you probably didn't see.
I did see the Muslim South Park with the Family
both
Guy.
Both parts.
They said they're going to show both parts, and I'm watching, and I only saw one part. So,
well, part two was this week.
Yeah, well, I saw this week. They were saying they're showing a rerun or whatever, and they're saying they're going to show both parts. So I only saw whatever I saw was one of the parts. I don't know if it was the first one or the second
one. You saw the first one, probably.
Okay.
It's another one of those meta issues where it's like a real storyline that happened with them and Comedy Central. So they made an episode about what really happened. Like they wanted to do when the Danish cartoons came out about showing the Prophet Muhammad.
Yeah.
They wanted to do something about that in Comedy Central. Apparently, you never really know what's real anymore and what's not with the South Park guys.
Apparently, the blank screen when Muhammad's handing the guy the football was most definitely real from Comedy Central's part.
Right, an actual Comedy Central censoring, so that they did this whole meta episode, and then they sort of roped Family Guy into it, and they just rip on Family Guy
for my God.
Two episodes.
Having the manatees that create that is
as
so
the
brutal.
Writers, where they take the idea balls from one side of the tank to the other, and then when they get five idea balls in a row, that's a Family Guy joke. And they completely rip on it, and it's so funny. And you've got Cartman every 5 minutes going, none of the jokes in Family Guy derive from the plot. They're completely inconsequential. It's ridiculous. And it's entirely accurate, and yet I love the Family Guy.
See, I do too. And that was what was so funny. It's one of those things that it was so mean, but so dead on in a certain way that it makes me start, wait, why do I love the Family Guy? Even though I do love it, it's one of those things that was so good was like, oh man, just the idea of having manatees with idea balls, where that came from is brilliant. It was just hilarious.
No, it really is. The South... And think about it, isn't it like their 10th season?
Yeah, exactly. Like 8 years, 10 seasons, it's incredible. Or 7 years, 10 seasons.
And they really are literally just as innovative, just as on the edge as they have ever been.
Absolutely.
Right, kudos to the entire South Park team. But before we completely go all the way up their butts with the brown nosing. So I saw a couple movies yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
DVDs I borrowed from you.
What's that?
My unending quest to convince myself that Mission Impossible 2 is better than it actually is.
Oh, man.
You know, so I watched it again yesterday. I think this is the third or fourth time I've seen it. Just because I'm convinced that every time I'm going to see it, it's better than I remember. And this time I realized, I really wasn't paying attention the last few times. This time I realized why I don't like it so much. John Woo.
Yeah.
I don't know what the hell he was trying.
He went off totally on the deep end.
It's just, and I realize it's such a tremendously stereotypical American film.
Yeah.
The action scenes are slow-mo. The plot is borderline inconsequential.
Well, it's funny. You know, those were all typical John Woo things that he'd been done. Sometimes, you know, with style, sometimes with crap, and he's like a Hong Kong guy.
Right. And, you know, the ridiculous bit with the dove, and it's his signature move, is there's these birds flying. And you're watching this, and you're going, well, just because it's a signature move doesn't mean it's a good idea.
You know what's funny is it's not entertaining. And most people I know saw it, didn't find it entertaining. Yet it just shows the power of this brand new franchise that it made a crap load of money.
Well, and there's this motorcycle chase that I was completely stoked to see. And I think last week we had mentioned they were Ducatis. I think they're actually Triumphs.
Oh, are they?
Okay. So they're British. They're a little different, but they're still cool motorcycles. And, you know, there's this move where he's rocketing down on this Triumph and he hops off the side of it. And he's basically dragging himself along the side to present, I guess, a lesser target to the oncoming, you know, attacker with the gun. And it's just the most ridiculous move ever. And I ride motorcycles, and that's so off the reservation in terms of feasibility.
Yeah.
You couldn't, you know, the best motorcycle riders in the world, you know, Valentino Rossi, they're not going to be pulling these moves. I mean, they, you know, control circumstances. They get a stunt guy to do it because he's wearing like rollerblade shoes or something. But you're just, it completely pulls you out of the movie in terms of its ridiculousness, despite the fact that it's so over the top to begin with.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, and it's a John Woo film. And then I think, well, wait a minute. What other John Woo films have I actually seen? Payday, which wasn't great.
Wait,
but at least it
Payday?
Didn't suck. That was the Ben Affleck, Uma Thurman. I think Aaron Eckhart was in it. He, you know, he's paid to do this job, and then they erase his mind for 2 years of his work, and he gets this gigantic paycheck, and then he learns what work he did. It wasn't stupid. I mean, it just kind of sat there. It wasn't horrible. It wasn't good. It was okay.
Well, he did Broken Arrow, that one with...
Oh, that's right. Christian Slater and John
Travolta. And I actually kind of liked that one.
I only saw it once. That was okay.
And then, of course, he did Face Off, which...
That's right.
Did
boy.
Really good business, and... But it's like, boy, you either love that or hate that. You have to get into the fact that
it was
totally,
okay. Now that you're mentioning all these films, I completely forgot he did.
And then the big one, he got paid a crap load of money to do, and it just tanked to an nth degree. Or they spent a great deal of money on was Wind Talkers with Nicolas Cage. It was about
that
the
was
Navajo
John Woo
talkers.
Film?
Yep, John Woo. And
wow.
they spent
well, they kept pushing
an enormous
it back.
Amount of money.
I remember seeing the trailers for like a year for that thing.
It just because it was a complete piece of crap and they just couldn't save it. So the movie cost $150
million. Are you prepared
to
kill your Wind Talker soldier? I'm prepared to kill my Wind Talker.
That was the thing. I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible wow. movie, a bad choice, so...
Well, and boy, you kind of hate to beat up on a guy, but he screwed that film up tremendously.
So are you glad you borrowed it?
I am.
You learned something.
Well, you know, when I'm watching a film for the second time on DVD, I'm surfing. I'm doing something else. I'm folding laundry. I'm surfing the web. So it's not like this is all I'm doing.
Yeah.
If that was all I'd been doing, then I'd have been pissed. The other one I borrowed was a Spartan.
Oh, yeah.
From Mammoth.
I haven't seen it yet.
Now, it's interesting because I had interest in seeing this when it came out in the theaters a couple of years ago. Yeah. And then I read it, and it got really mixed reviews.
Yeah.
Some reviewers loved it. It's got a big two thumbs way up blurb on the front of the packaging there. And some of the reviewers really ripped it, saying, this is so blasé. This is so by the numbers, so formulaic. And that sucked the wind out of me. Didn't end up seeing it. And then, of course, my source buys it, you, and I borrow it. I really enjoyed it.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I love Mammoth, and I noticed...
To a degree, it is formulaic, but it's well done.
But that's the way he works. He takes a formula, and he twists on it. But the thing about Mammoth is, god dang, his movies, I can't even think of one that didn't get like these weird mixed reviews. They always seems to, even ones that now are generally considered like House of Games, which is like the end all be all.
Still haven't seen it.
Well, I need to find it on DVD. It's such a great movie, but it was one of those movies that was, I mean, it was got weird reviews at the time. And I think the best reviewed movie he ever did was that one that took place in, it takes place like around 1900 and it stars his wife and, I can't remember who it was. Anyway, it was this weird, totally different movie for him, and it's called The Something Boy or The English Boy. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, it was a great movie, but the critics went nuts, and it was like they were just waiting for him to try something different. Well, you know, it is no different, better than the other ones. Oh, what was weird about that movie is David Mamet movie. It was rated G, and he did that for a reason. We forget that movies used to be rated G unless they had some particular thing in the 70s, something bad. It didn't mean it was a family movie. This wasn't necessarily not a family movie, just there was nothing wrong with it that should have caused it to be even PG. And normally the movie studios ask for a higher rating, just, and he specifically wanted to produce a rated G movie.
And
given the fact that David Mamet movies are so full of like emotional violence and swearing, it was kind of neat to see
Glenn Ross.
Exactly. Which, of course,
the pinnacle, the shining example of,
but of course he didn't direct that. Remember, he only wrote that and it was directed by what's his name, but it's like, that is the prototypical David Mamet on every level. So anyway, well, I'm glad you liked it. Looking forward to seeing it.
I really enjoyed it. Although, the bane of some of your movies, when you buy them used at Blockbuster, is that it looks like a kid maybe put them through a blender. You look at the, so scratched.
You need to buy a $40 DVD player instead of the $30
one. My DVD player, which, as I've mentioned in the past, was one of the first.
Yep.
I paid like $450 for it. One of the first generation DVD players, still mostly works fine.
Yeah.
But it's less tolerant of scratched discs than newer ones. I put it in, and I get about 7 minutes in before it just gives up. It completely gives up the ghost, and I think, okay, fine. My girlfriend has a much newer DVD player,
yep.
So I go put it in the bedroom one. It gets about 8 minutes in before it chokes, and I think, God dang it. Now I really want to see this film, and I got to give it back without having seen it. So it was a last-ditch effort yesterday. I put it in my Apple PowerBook yesterday. No hitches at all.
Yeah, a lot of the
really
computer ones.
Which really surprises me because it has choked before on scratched discs where it stops and says, I can't – here, this disc is undoable.
I notice a lot of the computer drives have – better error correction built in them. It sucks. There's been a couple of ways I've gotten where I've been, I mean, I always tell you, bring it back if it doesn't work. And it's like, you know, I paid $7 and it's like way out of the way. I'm not going to bother. And it's not like they're going to give me another one because I picked it up because it is the one copy that I've seen in 7 Blockbusters. So, and there's been a couple movies like that I got and that were really rare and I get it home and the dang thing doesn't work.
Just and scratched. And you, yeah. It just makes me, because I am so anal about my caring for my discs,
yeah,
and it drives me nuts, and I bitch about it, but then I realize, like, sometimes I'll come over, and you'll have a stack 20 high on your desk, and someone will be sitting on your floor, and I'll be like, oh.
Richard isn't quite as anal as I am.
Not quite. The other one I borrowed and watched is The Village.
Oh, yeah.
Which you had just seen a couple weeks ago yourself.
What's
from
your
M. Night
reaction?
Shyamalan. I really enjoyed it. I was very surprised.
Why did that thing get such bad reviews?
I think it was a mixture of things where reviewers were getting tired of forcing to write Shyamalan.
Oh, yeah, because
they probably had Shyamalan fatigue.
Remember the previous one when Signs came out? Shyamalan, the director, was on the cover of Newsweek, and they're calling him the next Spielberg. So I'll bet you people, they were just gunning for him.
And I thought it was, and you had pointed out, it's a beautifully shot film, yeah. And it is stunningly beautiful. Yep.
That Roger Deakins, man, he is a genius.
It's stunningly beautiful, and you had said that Sigourney Weaver had, like, bit part. I didn't see it. I saw it as more of an ensemble thing where...
I agree. It just sort of surprised me. Nobody hugely stood out, but I liked the fact that people were willing to play different characters, particularly, what's his name that won the Oscar? Adrian Brody played basically a mentally challenged guy and did a good job in other ones, but it was really, wasn't a big showy actory movie in a sense. And I kind of like that. I just was surprised that these stars would be willing to be sort of halfway into a movie without a big showy part.
And I think we're going to have to talk about the ending. So if you haven't seen The Village and you're interested in the end, skip ahead a couple minutes.
Exactly.
Because we're going to have to talk about it here.
So what's your thoughts on the big shot?
And unfortunately, I had managed to go like years without hearing what the big twist is.
Yeah.
And then randomly, someone in an article completely unrelated to it sort of spills the beans. Didn't do a complete spill the beans, but basically said, yeah, it turns out it's set in modern days. And I'm like, son of a...
Yeah, thanks.
Exactly. And the way they worded it in the article, I wasn't 100% sure that was the twist or a twist, or maybe there's five, you know. But so I watched it sort of expecting what was going on, and you kind of realize there are, not clues, but there are indices where, you know, the way they talk about the towns is their way of making the big boogeyman of the outside.
Yep.
And if you're paying attention, there's almost no religion in the thing.
Yep. Yep.
There's a funeral service and there's a mention or two of God, but there's no, there really, if you look, you can't really find a church.
Yep.
There's no overarching, you know, which you would, if it was authentically from the 1800s, you know, God and church would be all over the place, I would think, or the preacher would be, you know, the cock of the walk in that town. And if you think about it, as you're going through, there's no religion. So that's kind of a warning sign. But I thought it was very well put together. And as I mentioned in an email I wrote, you know, basically it's this village that takes place. It's in a wildlife preserve that one of the village elders that chose to come hide there, well, had apparently inherited a bunch of money and set this place up. And so, you know, it's feasible that, you know, not too many people go in there and are rooting around in the wildlife. And there's a privately paid security force that keeps people from doing that.
That aren't supposed to know anything about it. They just keep people out.
Right. And so regardless of how plausible that is, to me, it was plausible enough.
Yeah.
And then the big thing was, where are the airplanes?
I know. You know, it's funny when they brought that up. I'm, of course, the whole time, because I had heard or figured it out before, so I'm the whole time going airplanes, thinking about that. And it was funny because clearly Shyamalan and others knew that's going to be people's major question, so they give an explanation about how they're paying, you know, the airplanes not to fly over, or they've changed the routes,
the way
or
they
something
did it. I thought was pretty smart, because it was sort of a throwaway line.
Exactly.
It's, you know, the one guard in the security shack talking to the other guard, and it doesn't feel too forced. But, and I just thought, you know what, whether or not you buy that as plausible, that it's plausible, they addressed it.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that they did that, because to me, so many times I'm watching a film and there's just this gigantic plot hole and you're just like, God dang it. How hard would it have been to throw in a line or two to address that?
Well, who's the writer that talks about that, saying how, oh, when they get plot holes, like they're, oh, and I think it's like in... It's in the movie Thank You for Smoking.
Oh,
and
really?
I think it's Rob Lowe. And Rob Lowe is so good in this movie. And he said, I think it's him, and they're talking about how he's trying to get a product placement of cigarettes in the big new Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie movie or something, but it's going to cost him like $20 million. And the movie, it's this movie set on a space station in space. And then the guy from the cigarette company goes, but something to the effect of, but you can't smoke in space, it's like a pure oxygen environment, will blow up. Oh God, no, that's that one line, we can solve it in post. One line, thank God we invented the thing. And that's how they describe it. One line, thank God we invented the thing. And that's how they solved it. So, and it's funny how so many movies may have been actually rescued by thinking of those things at the last minute. This one here, I think pretty much Shyamalan was thinking that from the very beginning, that we better have something as an aside and do it, because it did work beautifully and didn't come across as, thank God we invented the thing that somebody like Mouse with their head turned, because it's obviously done in post.
Right. And then so, I'm kind of thinking throughout the thing, well, how, what are these red creatures in the red robes, and are they actually, because that, you know, that was still a mystery for me. It's like, are they actually creatures? And then you get a look and you're like, well, that robe looks pretty well made.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really know what was going on there. And then as soon as they start heading towards the forbidden shed, it's like, oh, well, okay, that I get it now. But then towards the end, when Bryce Howard is tromping through the forest and you sort of see the one creature off to the side, you know, with the music and the way they cut it together, I was a little scared. I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what was going on until they show the creature running and you can tell it's very guy in the suit. You're like, oh, okay, it's just another guy in a suit, and then it's Adrian Brody, and
You know what's funny is I have to be careful about, you know, working on my computer while watching movies because I'll miss little things. It was about halfway through the movie, maybe two-thirds of the way through the movie, when I realized Bryce Dallas Howard is blind. I had
Now,
somehow
see, I
missed
remember that
that.
from the promo from when the
I
movie came out.
just missed it. And for whatever reason, the way she was looking just didn't seem obvious to me. And when they were sending her off, I go, what is the big deal? And then there is, oh, she's blind and that's the big, you know, it just was, it was weird.
Well, because,
So.
Shyamalan does not make he doesn't beat you over the head with obvious points like that. He makes you figure out that she's blind.
Yep.
There isn't like some immediate line like, well, hello, character, how's your walking cane today? Or, you know, some ridiculously obvious thing like that.
Well, I'll tell you, it just made me look forward to his Girl in the Water movie now. I'm just starting
Which.
to think. I don't know what it is, but I just risk. I've really enjoyed pretty much all of his movies.
And as have I. And I'm looking forward to it as well. Even though it's probably not a typical big twist,
It's a fairy tale.
right? Well, it's a bedtime
Or a
story,
bedtime story.
and I'm thinking, wow, okay, Lady in the Water,
Lady in the Water, that's it.
Bryce Howard, perhaps she'll be naked and wet,
Lady naked in the
because that would
water,
be my bedtime
bathing
story.
herself.
Oh my.
Anyway.
Seems unlikely since it was like based on a story told as a kid or something,
Yeah,
but
who knows?
that would be my personal bedtime story. Great movie. I have no pro I recommend
I
The
wish he
Villain.
didn't do a commentary track. I wish he did, because he's done pretty cool ones on other ones, and he's a really fun, self-effacing guy. And I was like, God, where's the goddamn commentary?
We sort of briefly mentioned last week, you had asked if I'd seen the cover for the latest Entertainment Weekly with the Superman
Oh yeah,
pose.
what'd you think of
Maybe
that?
that was just in an email you sent.
Yeah.
I finally got that issue from my recycled John source
Yeah.
when he gives me like 10 at once. You're right. It was. I don't have a problem with the cowlick, the spit curl, whatever
It
you
was
call it.
like this. It was like this impossibly molded. Looked like it was made of
I don't have a
rubber.
problem with that, but you're right. The pose looks weird, and to me, I think a lot of it has to do with the costume. The Superman costume does not look good in still photos.
Yeah, I think that's it.
I'm guessing they did a ton of pre-production work to figure out what would look good on film,
Yeah.
and so I'm assuming it's going to look good on film. But when you get a still photo, it just ends up looking weird,
Well, I started to.
especially for me, the cape,
I
because it
know.
looks like it's this weird, like nylon thing that
Yep.
they just grabbed out of a bag.
The colors look weird too, and I sort of go, boy, I don't know how they could win, because you know with the X-Men and others, they could tweak them and make them look like this more modern
Right.
thing, and you only have so much to do here, so they literally clearly muted the colors, but oh
Yeah,
my
the
God.
Superman costume is very problematic to integrate
Yeah.
into a real world type of film because it's so out there. You know, with X-Men, they're wearing leather and there's some explanation. With Batman, he's sort of, in the last film, you
Yeah.
know, the explanation sort of grows naturally. He's sort of
Yeah.
invoking this fear response and there's some technical reasons for it to look as it does and blah, blah, blah. But with Superman, it's so out there and so primary and so vibrant and so hard to come up with a plausible explanation for a guy wearing this getup looking like it does.
It also had a weird, I've never noticed, but it had a weird texture, like a
Oh,
canvas
I've
texture.
noticed the texture before.
And I'm certain in the movie there's some explanation, because of course, how do you sew a super costume and other stuff? So there's probably something to it or
I
something.
remember once in the comics there was an explanation like Superman's invulnerable field force extended a quarter of an inch outside his body,
Oh
which is
man.
why his costume wouldn't get ripped up constantly.
Anyway, it's like I looked at that and I kind of got depressed. I'm going, jeez, I hope this movie is as
I
great as I've been
didn't,
wanting it to be. I'm sure it
yeah.
will be, but that pose looked really
Yeah,
retro and not
once,
in a good
and
way.
I hadn't realized that before, but looking at that cover shot, I realized, you know what? I think it's just that it looks horrible in still
Yeah.
photos.
Inside it looked better. They had a still photo where they took a picture of him and him as Clark Kent,
Right.
and that looked a lot better. The cowlick looked
I
natural
remember,
and
God, you know The Tick,
yeah.
which started out as a comic book by Ben Edlund, and it
Yep.
was a hysterical comic book. And there was he in the first couple issues, he did a Superman parody where Clark Kent was Clark Oppenheimer, and he's running around, and like there's a point, and the Tick ends up working at the new same newspaper,
Yep.
and he accident and he's just this really irritating guy, and he ends up accidentally breaking Clark's glasses, and so the Clark Kent figure in the comic book does that thing where he does this, he puts the hands upside down over his face with the and it makes his hands glasses, and it's hysterical. It is. I'm describing a comic book, what a horrible thing to do in a podcast.
And I was going to say, and also doing that with your hand in a way. But you did do a good job of describing it. I did love The Tick. I thought that was a funny show. I never read the comic.
It's an interesting story because, you know, actually he only made like 12 issues of the comic book for an independent publisher, New England Comics, NEC. And then from that, it sort of took off. It turned into a Saturday morning cartoon, which did very well and was very well written.
Yeah.
I saw quite a few of them.
Was
very
it Saturday morning?
God, I'm pretty sure it was.
Yeah, I think you're right, but I only saw it like in reruns on.
It did very well there. Yeah. Then it was a live action series for half a season, which it was pretty good. I really liked Patrick Warburton as the. I think it did pretty good. And then Ben Edlund, the creator, sort of went on to work on Buffy and Firefly. I think he was on Buffy. I know he was on Firefly, and then he was Angel. That's what I meant to say. Angel and Firefly.
Cool.
So he really is doing well, and he's done quality work. Ben Edlund, based out of The Tick, sort of got off on a tangent there, as we are wont to do. You know what I was gonna mention back for Mission Impossible 2?
What's that?
The bad guy, Doug Ray Scott.
Yep.
He was supposed to be Wolverine in X-Men.
Was he really?
He was originally cast. The filming on Mission Impossible 2 went long, and he could not, once they realized he could not report to the X-Men set on time, they sort of frantically started casting about who else do we have, and Hugh Jackman was cast, who just did such a great job and is now practically a household name.
Yeah.
And has done a lot of work in terms of saying, I'm not just Wolverine.
Yeah.
You know, he's, you know, starred in Oklahoma and has done a lot of stage work and has really done a good job of saying, I'm not just Wolverine, but I'm enjoying Wolverine too.
Yeah.
He's doing a good job of distancing himself, but also saying, you know, I'm enjoying the character.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, because I saw in the Entertainment Weekly that Doug Ray Scott played Moses in the Ten Commandments for ABC. And I'm thinking, boy, how different would that guy's career have been if MI2 had not gone long and he had been able to be Wolverine and X-Men? It's like, little things like that, and suddenly a career.
For such a crappy
movie. Not to say that Doug Ray Scott's career is in the toilet or anything, but what would his career have done if he had actually been able to be in X-Men?
Yeah, for such a crappy movie. It'd be one thing if he was in Citizen Kane and it ran long, but.
God, no kid. Something else I saw last week was. And I probably hadn't seen it in about 10 years, Blade Runner.
Oh, yeah.
The director's cut.
Director's cut.
Which was interesting for a number of reasons. Parts of it were a lot more boring than I remember, quite honestly.
Really?
Where I just found myself really surfing the web and engrossed in whatever I was doing there. And I'd look up, oh, look, they're still being boring. But I was paying more attention to the whole... Is the Harrison Ford character Deckard a replicant himself?
Yeah.
Because I guess this has sort of become...
Well, they make it it pretty obvious.
In science fiction circles, it's sort of become, is he a replicant? And I remember thinking, not once had I ever thought that, the few times I had seen the movie. And I'm like, where are they getting that from? And even after watching it this time, I'm like, where did that come from? And then the next day at work, before you interject...
No problem.
In our conversation, before you have a chance
to speak
up.
Were you watching the DVD or watching on TV?
The DVD.
Okay, because did you listen to the commentary?
No, I don't even know if that one had a commentary.
You can borrow mine and you can listen to the commentary.
But I listened, and because I know that a couple of years ago, Ridley Scott just comes out and says, well, duh, I wanted him to be a replicant.
Yeah.
And I mentioned it in a computer chat the next day, one of my friends, and they're like, oh, well, here you go. And there's a Wikipedia article, of course, on it. I don't know why I didn't think to look there. And there's actually a case for each, a case for Deckard not being a replicant and a case for him being a replicant.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to read, but the big case for is that at the end, the little origami thing is a unicorn.
Is his memory.
The Edward James Olmos Gath character wouldn't know that unless he knew that the dreams were unicorn dreams that were programmed in, which I was too dense to get. I just thought it was a friggin' unicorn.
Well, and that said, the original cut of the movie, that wasn't in
the
cut.
Yeah, it wasn't in the movie.
So and that was the thing. And the original cut was so famously, everybody savaged it because it had the voiceover of Harrison Ford that everybody hated. And that was a case of not everybody hated it. They just knew that they tacked it on later. So all the critics who loved to hear about the inside making the movie, especially back then, because you didn't have all these articles, they could inform people and they could trash this voiceover, which actually wasn't all that bad. But anyway, so they cut out that little element. They just tried to make it a straightforward, this guy's looking for these people, and what's his name was trying to make a much more nuanced film. And even though I think he said, yeah, of course he was a replicant, I think he actually wanted it to be an either or case. And well, and that particular thing makes it's so subtle, but it makes it 100% clear that he's a replicant.
Right. Although you go to the Wikipedia thing and you start saying a couple different things like the screenplay, right? This guy who did the screenplay. Yeah. Well, A, the Philip K. Dick novel or yep. short story. He's clearly a human. Apparently, I haven't read
it
myself.
Do androids dream of electric sheep?
The guy who did the screenplay wrote him as a human.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford said he played him as a human.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have Ridley Scott saying, no, he's a replicant. And then there's evidence. There's like a box for each, and there's evidence for each saying, well, he's not strong enough to fight the Rutger Hauer character at the end. Interestingly enough, they use that same thing in the other box saying, well, he was strong enough to last in a fight.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. You know, Rutger Hauer knew his name. How can you know his name? Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that was interesting. Just sort of looking at it from that perspective, and you're right, it is more nuanced, and
yeah,
I kind of don't know where I was going with my point other than I saw it. It was more boring than I remember, but
well, the listen to the commentary track was pretty cool just because he does great commentary tracks, so it's like one of those things that I'm going, oh, good, oh, I'm in the soothing tones of one of his, you know, Ridley Scott commentary track. What was his most recent one? Oh, the one
Kingdom of Heaven.
Kingdom of Heaven, I don't know if the special edition's out yet, but that's definitely a keeper for a commentary track. You got to assume. I didn't like the movie, but from everything I hear, the special edition really makes it a good movie. And for whatever reason, I've been reading about that era lately, and so it makes it infinitely more reason for me to want to go back
Turkish
and see
prison,
that.
Joey? You watch Gladiator movies, Joey.
It's funny. They don't make many jokes about child molestation in movies these days.
Okay. What else do I have on my list? Blade Runner. Oh, this is interesting. Well, yeah, a bunch of my friends got together yesterday morning because my girlfriend thought it would be fun to recreate Saturday morning cartoon watching. And we watched a bunch of Looney Tunes from the DVDs.
Nice.
And there was one Foghorn Leghorn cartoon. And a lot of these, you know, they're pretty violent.
Yep.
And yet, you know, a whole generation of kids grew up watching Looney Tunes with Bugs and the Wile E. Coyote and are just fine. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And then you look at something like Speedy Gonzales, where there's all these racial overtones, which I'm fine with. But we were watching a Foghorn Leghorn cartoon yesterday.
I support racial overtones. I'm not just fine with
them. Wow, that's Richard talking, by the way. But there's a Foghorn Leghorn cartoon where he literally sort of turns to the camera and says, a boy's so dumb he'd think a Mexican border would pay the rent.
Wow.
And everyone was just, what?
Wow.
What the hell was that?
Nice.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's just right there. It's a racist joke in the middle of this Looney Tunes cartoon. I literally don't remember that.
Wow.
And I'm perfectly okay with that being cut out for it being rerun on the TV.
Yeah.
That is really over the line.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. everyone was just floored. I'm fine with them being violent. I'm fine with the Speedy Gonzales stuff.
You've seen all the old Disney cartoons from World War II where they have the Japanese and...
No, actually, I know of them. And
God dang, they're like... They got these, like... sharp slanty eyes, and it's like you could not get a more, at least drawing wise, a more awful stereotype. And you don't blame Disney for wanting to systematically hide that from their history. It's funny, we're coming up on 75 years since they produced them, but
yeah,
they still hide
them. It but you put a big asterisk saying, look,
you would, but
we did this and we feel horrible about it now, but this is why we did it at the time.
You would totally think that, and but Disney buries them. They simply don't let them be released.
You can understand why.
I totally can understand why, but on the flip side, you'd think that they would make other brownie points another way just to release, say, hey, here is a part of our history, having commentators explain what was going on and put them into context. I think anybody would understand in context, but anyway.
Yeah, Yeah, that's a kind of a hard marketing push, though.
Yeah.
What else do I have on my list?
Oh, did you see the Pelicano thing? Did I send you the link about
With McTiernan?
Yeah, John McTiernan. Yeah. I hadn't heard that, but oh, he may be in trouble. He lied.
The director of Die Hard and Hunt for Red October, John McTiernan, apparently lied to the FBI during the Pelicano investigation.
Apparently, everybody in town knew that Pelicano could wiretap people, so they would just seek him out to go spy on their people that they didn't like. Apparently, if you didn't like somebody, you wanted to get dirt on somebody in Hollywood, you went to this guy. And there apparently there's a whole bunch of other Hollywood people just quaking their boots that their names are going to come out. But McTiernan made the cardinal mistake of when they asked him about him, he said, "Oh, I don't really know him." And now they know. Oh, he knew him very, very well, and that's the problem. It's one thing to you know, have hired the guy, but it's another thing to lie about it.
Well, Barry Bonds did the same thing in his steroid thing, and now they're talking about indicting him for lying to the grand jury.
Absolutely.
For that.
What do you think Martha Stewart went to prison for? It wasn't for the original thing; it was for lying about it.
God, and there was a West Wing actually incorporated that into the script at one point. You know, why do FBI agents come in pairs? Why do they interview in pairs? Since it's a felony to lie to the FBI, the other agent acts as a corroboration if you lie. That way it's not just your word against another.
Wow.
That's smart.
Absolutely.
I assume that's true. It sounds true.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, I heard it in a West Wing, so you kind of have to wonder how true is it, but...
Well, that's the beauty of West Wing. Whether it's true or not, it sounds true. That makes it true.
West Wing, as it winds down... The last episode was the election results. Would you like to hear the election?
Did Jimmy
results?
Smits win?
He did.
I know he won because I read the thing. Okay. He wasn't. They were doing this thing about what's. I don't know if I sent you the article about when. What was his name? That the McGarry.
John Spencer.
John Spencer when he passed away and they had a totally different end result, but then they realized, boy, if we don't have Jimmy Smits win. People are gonna have this weird bitter taste in their mouth. Originally, they were gonna lose there was some other total election going on.
I haven't heard about that.
I'll have to send you the link. But they had to rewrite how they were gonna end this series.
I think a lot of people didn't really know how the election was going to turn out because, well, for dramatic reasons.
Well, they had a bunch of interviews with the writers and where they're saying how and why how they were having to change things because of how they perceived the fans were gonna be. Because of the whole
McGarry. Sort of another interesting aspect that I wanted to talk about briefly was, you know, you've got the Alan Alda Republican senator from California character who as the election wears on, the election day and night especially, they just, you know, they're talking about recounts and do we sue for a recount and are we having lawyers challenge election results and what are we doing about that? And at the end, the Alan Alda character decides not to do that. You know, I'm going to, it's 30,000 or 300,000 votes in Nevada. I think it was 30,000. I'm not going to ask for a recount. Sort of doing the honorable thing. And a couple of reviewers have said, there's no, you know, that, it's a fantasy. It's the West Wing writers idealistic little fantasy world where the candidate is too honor bound to
but
say.
But that's sort of what Gore did in Florida in 2000 until people started to realize you're an idiot. You need to make these statements. Otherwise, you're not going to be allowed to question them later.
Well,
So it's sort of like what Gore did. I hear what they're saying.
And
in this environment,
although within
no.
the context of the West Wing, there was no allegation of actual fraud, really. There were some hints about some monkey business, but there wasn't anything blatant, and there wasn't any criminal case about it. They're just talking about recounts in a larger sense.
Well, if it was 30,000, it doesn't matter. It'd be automatic anyway.
That's what different states have different laws about what percentage automatically triggers a recount. Yeah. And actually, they didn't address that at all. And I'm turning to my girlfriend saying, well, this is ridiculous because there'd be there's a level at which an automatic recount is triggered anyway.
Yeah.
And the other frustrating thing, because Oregon ended up being one of the final states, Oregon is all absentee ballot.
Yeah, 100%.
Which wasn't mentioned at all. They're talking about the polls closing, and I'm like, that's not exactly a hard fact. And
That's too bad because usually it's so
made me
smart
a little cranky.
And you get insight. And if they didn't know that, you know, 80% of the people in Oregon had voted 2 weeks earlier minimum.
Exactly, because it has to be, I think in Oregon they have to be received by the date as opposed to postmarked by the election
exactly
date.
Exactly right.
But what's sort of interesting is the, you know, sort of the phrase of the West Wing writer's little fantasy world. And in terms of, you know, how much should, you know, it's art influencing life, art reflecting life. And you look at something like Blade Runner, which is sort of a dystopian, it really was the first dystopian future vision in terms of science fiction films.
And now they're all that way.
Well, not the first, but it did it so well. And it's so stylistic. And
yeah, but it set the standard. And now it's like, oh, hey, here's another dystopian vision of the future.
Right, and then you look at something like Star Trek, where Gene Roddenberry had this very, very firm, no, humanity makes it.
Yeah.
And he said there were firm rules in the Star Trek Bible about that is like no conflict on the ships, and
yep.
You know, which really from an acting and writing standpoint constrains you. But, yep. But it really that, you know, a lot of the reason why people are so drawn to Star Trek is there's this vision of humanity making it, not destroying itself. And look, we make it. And you look at, you know, for, on a smaller scale, West Wing, and look, the good guys are running the country and doing, they're trying to do good. They're not trying to just power monger and, you know, hook their friends up with money because they're in power. And you kind of be, boy, you know, yes, it's a little fantasy world, but maybe people will be influenced by that.
Yeah.
When they eventually, you know, maybe a young person sees that and, you know, wants to do it. And that's the goal. Or someone watches Star Trek and says, you know, I want to achieve that vision. And that person actually makes it happen. And you kind of say, well, yes, it's ridiculous they're living in the democratic little fantasy world. But on the other hand, you want that vision to come to reality.
That's what makes those shows so powerful, because they appeal to that portion of us that is as idealistic and wants that stuff to happen.
And, you know, and it's, you know, both of us are liberals. That's fine. And you look at the West Wing and you say, yes, there's some liberal ideology bandied about, except for the season after Sorkin, when the writers sort of went off on this, let's make it more conservative thing, which
that's
was just
the country we're living in, apparently
just retarded.
Yeah.
But it's not even so much the liberal philosophy of the West Wing. It's just good people trying to do good.
Yep.
You know, which is regardless of Republican or Democrat, you know, because they've had honorable, like the Alan Alda character,
absolutely
honorable Republican.
Yep.
You know, and holding that up saying, look, we don't hate Republicans. We hate scummy Republicans.
Yeah.
We hate scummy Democrats.
Yep.
They haven't really put a lot. Anyway, I'm sort of rambling here to the detriment. But
sounds like you're going to miss that show when it ends.
I really am. But I have all the DVD sets, so
yeah,
it will live on in my DVD player forever.
I haven't watched it in a couple of years, a lot of shows. I'll probably watch the season finale and not really know what the hell's going on, but I have to see the season.
You know, it's somewhat inspiring because you wish that Washington really worked like that.
Yeah.
Good people doing good work, and then you turn on the news and you turn on the Daily Show and you see the opposite, basically.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
A couple tech things of note. HD DVDs are finally being released.
Really?
Actual players for $500, I guess.
Wow, that's not that
actually
bad,
available
actually
for purchase. And still no word on Blu-ray.
Yeah, and I don't really even care. I'll just wait for it to all settle down. And I'll get whatever.
Well, because we've amply discussed this in the past, but you know, there was a blurb about a Sony exec in Europe was quoted as saying that a PlayStation 3 would be like €500 or €600.
Yeah.
And
well, their costs, costs of these things are $900, and boy, it just tanks.
And then it
Sony
went. I mean, that rumor went around the world in a minute.
Yep.
And for like a day or two, everyone was saying, "Well, if you do the translation, that's like $600 or $700 for a PS3."
It was $800. That was the what they were saying. Well, so they were saying they were going to have
the rumor you listened to.
Okay. But they were saying that, I mean, to sell them, they'd have to take like a $500 loss on every unit.
And it took Sony like 2 days. When I was surprised it took them as long as it did to come out and say, no, misquoted.
Yeah.
What the guy was really saying was, if the PS3 sold for that amount, it would be a bargain because it has this Blu-ray capability.
Yeah.
Which that's kind of an awkward back off, an awkward step back. And you can kind of see Sony's whole game plan in terms of, well, no matter what we charge for it, it's going to be a bargain because it's going to have this awesome Blu-ray player. And I think you're right. The consumers are going to be, I'm not buying jack squat until there's one.
Yeah.
It's this whole HD DVD Blu-ray thing is just a disaster.
It doesn't matter to me. I want the content or whatever, and I'm willing to. I don't really care. I'm just willing to wait for it to be a cheap, easily available thing, and I'm not so.
Which is funny because we're the sort of people that they need to be concerned
exactly.
about. We're not the bleeding edge adopters. We don't spend $10,000 on the latest thing. Yep.
But we're the next level down.
We're just a tick under that.
Yep.
And we're both movie fanatics.
Yep.
And if they haven't convinced us that we need to buy all of our crap again at the HD DVD level, the Blu-ray level, then they have a problem.
You know, it's funny when I watch HD on TV or whatever, I love it. I love watching it. It looks great. And it's clearly demonstrably much, much better than regular TV. That said, when I go back to regular TV, doesn't really faze me a whole hell of a lot. So it's, although it is unquestionably better, it's not so much when I go back to regular quality, doesn't really faze me all that much. With DVD, there was so many benefits over the tape.
Right.
The fact that you can instantly get to it, it simply looked a million times better.
Do you remember what your first DVD was?
Yeah, mine was American Graffiti.
Really?
Yeah, I remember I got my Gateway computer like in 98. I just started working at Paws. And I went to the store and I was looking there and going, look at these things. And I knew mine had a DVD player, so I bought American Graffiti, and then it had this really cool little interviews at the end with Lucas and other people and Cindy Williams and Ron Howard and stuff. It was kind of cool, but it just, I was blown away by, there's this interview at the end. And then there's a little thing about how they deleted how he always wanted to get rid of this one shot at the beginning of this building behind the diner. But other than that, it was, you know, I can't remember the first one I ever got where I think the first one I remember getting where it had a commentary track that I remember thinking, wow, now I know I like DVDs. And that was Go. I remember getting Go.
Yeah.
It was like my 15th DVD I'd purchased, and I'd listened to some commentary tracks and it wasn't, you know, nothing, but that one's like, that's why I'm going to love these things. 'Cause I so enjoyed that. And it so furthered the experience for me that I think it was Go by Doug Liman that changed everything for me.
I remember I bought my DVD player as a college graduation present to myself.
Cool.
And I brought it home to the apartment along with The Fifth Element and Aliens.
Wow.
Those are my first two DVDs. And then there was a deal. If you buy the DVD player and send in like the proof of purchase, you could get 5 DVDs by mail.
Yeah.
And I remember it was Matilda.
Yep.
The kids film
Danny
with
DeVito.
Danny DeVito. Lost in Space.
Yep. I didn't think that was that bad.
Let me come back to Lost in Space. Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Wow, nice selection.
Devil's Advocate, Al Pacino.
Yeah.
Kind of a, not, and
naked,
Canary's,
naked
not a very good movie, but there's a hot naked redheaded chick towards the end.
And there's
so
naked Charlize Theron.
There's a good freeze frame aspect to that. What was the fifth? Lethal Weapon 4.
Oh, what a horrible movie. The one with Chris Rock.
Yeah, so I...
Jet Li.
Yeah, and God, those movies. Lost
wow,
in
that's
Space.
A pretty motley
I tried to watch that again a couple years ago. Horrible.
I kind of like Lost in Space.
Maybe I'll give it another shot, but
it's not as bad as Thunderbirds, but we were trying to go for a feel.
God,
and
it was oh.
I liked all the gals in their hot leather suits. There's Mimi Rogers,
Heather Graham.
And then what's her name was just a little too young at the time, but is smoking now.
But it was just
Danger Will Robinson.
I had no problem with that. Anyway, I don't know. I'm so apoplectic about how bad that movie was. I can't even articulate it.
I didn't go through many bad ones. I started out getting good or ones that I thought were relatively good. I still have a few just out and out stinkers, but for the most part, I never really did the let's just get them for the sake of getting them. I really started seeking them out. And at the beginning, it was all Costco Then it was all Amazon.com until...
I remember Tower Records had a really good selection.
And they still do an amazing selection. But the problem is, it's weird. I remember all my first DVDs, the first years, they were all full priced, all $25, $30. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, now what? Was I on crack? And it was because... And I remember there was that day that Blockbusters announced that they're getting rid of VHSs, phasing them out, bringing in DVDs. And they hadn't even really brought them in yet. But they're basically announcing they're converting completely over. And I remember getting really excited about that because I knew it was going to mean cheaper DVDs. And sure enough, within about a year, I discovered the cheap DVD, you know, sales that they would have at Blockbusters for $10 and then $7, sometimes $5 a DVD. And that's pretty much the way I get 95% of them now.
Yeah.
And as they, you find out, they come scratched and messed up.
The other interesting tech note from a couple weeks ago was the fact that Apple has now enabled the boot, that they released the beta of the Boot Camp software, which lets you run Incredible. Windows on the new Apple computers with the Intel chips.
Oh, that's a beta.
It's a beta.
Wow. Because apparently it works perfectly. It's got a few quirks.
There's some people who've had installation difficulties.
Oh, really?
But it works well enough for a beta. I guess it's going to be an integral part of the 10.5 operating system.
Means my next computer will almost certainly be a Mac.
And so one of the blogs I read pointed out that someone, initially they couldn't get the Media Center Edition to work, but there's now a way to do it.
Yeah.
So you can now run Windows Media Center Edition on a Mac Mini, which I have to poke into that. That's a very plausible solution because I've heard that the Media Center Edition is a very good, at this point, piece of software and works really well because it has this DVR functionality, which the stuff for the Mac doesn't yet.
Yep.
You can get a third-party solution like ITV's Gato or maybe some OpenWare stuff or do some Linux thing, but which drives me nuts. Why doesn't Apple have a DVR solution yet?
You got to assume they're completely working on it. They want it to do it
Let's hold them back. Let's go.
And you would hope it wouldn't be a case
Windows has had it for years.
Well, you would certainly hope it wouldn't be a case of Apple, of the business side, infringing on their technology side, meaning the relationships they've developed with ABC.
I wouldn't think
but you would hope not, but this thing does hold other people back sometimes, and you'd hope that these relationships they've had with these content partners aren't going, you're not going to make it super easy to do all this stuff or whatever. You would hope that.
It's driving me nuts because I'm getting close. This summer, I'm finally going to get an HD TV, and I'm going to get some sort of computer solution hooked up in there.
Yep.
And if Apple doesn't have a DVR by then, I could very well use the Media Center Edition on a Mac and do it that way. And
well, you'll be able to switch back and forth. You'll be able to. Well, that's the only downside of that is that it's great, but essentially the point to the Media Center Editions, the point to them is you're leaving it, it's an appliance, and you're leaving it running all the time, which sort of negates to some extent, this is my computer that I can switch back and forth to these uses.
Oh, well, see, if I get that sort of box, I wouldn't use it as a computer.
You're just using
it
just
for
that. It's just for
video and audio, you know, songs and whatnot.
Yeah.
God, cool. Then it gets complicated because the Mac Minis, the current ones, don't really have that big a hard drive. It's like 100 gigs.
I know.
And then you start thinking, well, if I get an external hard drive, that's one solution. Do I get a whole file server?
Yeah.
That's my current thinking is just get a blank box and stuff it full of hard drives
and use it
as a file server.
Serve across your house. I mean,
exactly.
That's
my current thinking. But every time I really get into working it, I get a headache and I'm like, I'm not even doing this now anyway. Hmm. But so the ability to use Media Center Edition, that's, I think some people might actually.
I'm very excited about it, man. I know my dad, his next computer is going to be probably one of those iMacs and he is excited. I mean, to replace his old one because he now has access to all those damn Windows games. I mean, the simple fact is Mac has always been a better platform for gaming and they have the worst games ever. So anyway, so we should wrap this up, dude.
All right. You can always send us email. Send us customer feedback, if you will, at youguysrock@mustardayonnaise.com. I'm Matt.
I'm Richard.
Thanks for listening.
Adios.